Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. I'm delighted to be joined today by Karen Howe, who is a journalist who's written for a number of publications, including The Atlantic and The Wall Street Journal, and is also the author of a new book, Empire of AI, which is just out. And it explores a very interesting story, which is the story of OpenAI, probably the leading company of the AI boom. And it's quite a controversial story, isn't it, Karen? And that's one that revolves around Sam Altman, who is increasingly emerging as a very important but slightly objectionable figure, it seems, in the world of AI. What are your thoughts on Sam Altman?
Yeah, Sam Altman is, he's an interesting guy. He is very much a product of Silicon Valley. So his talent is his ability to tell stories about the future that people want to be a part of. That has gotten him very far in his career. He rose very quickly from being a founder of his own company that failed to being the president of one of the most acclaimed startup accelerators, Y Combinator, in Silicon Valley, to now being the CEO of OpenAI. But it is also the thing that has led him to be followed by controversy his entire career. And part of the reason is because he also has a loose relationship with the truth. And so he's able to tell really compelling stories to different people, depending on what he needs from them, based on saying to them what he understands that they need to hear to be motivated towards a particular direction. That's really effective in one-on-one meetings when you're an investor. It becomes much more complicated when you're trying to run an organization where people need to have a shared foundation of truth. And so throughout his career, as that friction has built within the organizations that he has been the head of, there have been many moments where senior executives in his organizations have been approached the board or approached someone more, even more senior to Altman, to suggest that he needs to depart because he's creating a lot of friction and a lot of chaos.
Mm. And it's hard to exaggerate the power that he now has or potentially wields in the future, because as the senior people you mentioned within OpenAI recognize, they're talking about something that is world-changing, possibly humanity-altering. And yet he does seem to be this figure that, you're putting it rather politely there, but I mean, some might accuse him being a very, very high-level grifter, essentially.
He's definitely in charge of something, of making really profound decisions about technology that is going to influence the trajectory of humanity. I do want to take a step back, though, and say what I argue in my book is slightly different. The consequences of AI are slightly different from, I think, what the average public narrative about AI is. You know, the typical narratives get really divorced into two extremes. One is that AI will bring us to utopia, and the other one is AI will kill us all. And what I argue is that this technology is profound, not necessarily just because of what it can do, but because of what people think it can do. And it's reshaping our economy and terraforming our earth right now based on the belief that people have of its possibilities. And that, I think, is actually more consequential. The fact that Altman can rally people to cede him an extraordinary amount of resources, amount of capital, lease him land, give him energy, water, to build these systems that actually, in fact, are not panning out to have that much of an economic impact thus far, and are actually showing a bit of a middling performance. That is the thing that we really need to focus on as the really profound potential that we might be going down a path that is very, very difficult to unwind later down the road when we might realize this technology is not what we think it is.
With the trajectory of AI, you see something similar to what happened at the beginning of the internet and so on, where it has these very utopian ideals at the beginning. And that certainly seems to have been the case with OpenAI. And it's Altman has clashed with those ideals quite early and survived and come out on top. But the company itself has gone in a direction that the utopian people are not happy with.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call them the utopian people. I would call them very idealistic people who are actually in the camp of the dystopians, people who believe that if AI will not be governed well, even one wrong action could have devastating consequences for humanity because of this idea, this belief that they have, and I describe it in the book as a quasi-religious belief that they have, that AI could develop consciousness and could start having its own desires and actions and go rogue and escape the control of humans. And so because they have this deep-seated belief and because they think that there is this extremely high stakes of you could either enter heaven or enter hell, depending on what, as in you can bring humanity to heaven or hell based on what kind of decisions they make early on when they're shaping and quote unquote giving birth to this technology. All of the typical personality flaws that Altman has that maybe in another company context would have been just chalked up to typical Silicon Valley founder. You know, a lot of Silicon Valley founders are like this. The stakes feel a lot higher when you're in the mind frame of, wait a minute, but this could actually lead to total devastation. And so I think this is kind of gets at the heart of one of the things that I think is important to understand about the way that AI is being developed today within Silicon Valley is that there's an ideological clash that's happening. There are ego clashes that are happening to shape this technology. And ultimately, what I really advocate for is we should not be trying to develop such a profoundly consequential technology that could actually have lots of benefits if we do it well, and rest it in the hands of people, individuals that are flawed, that have a lot of personal professional baggage, that are ultimately currently making decisions just based on personality and quasi-religious belief differences.
Just on that spiritual point, the creators, I was amazed there's a bit from your book that's extracted in The Atlantic that I read, that they actually use the term the rapture to talk about. And is the rapture, am I right in thinking the rapture in their minds is the moment when AI goes into sort of super intelligence?
You know, I actually don't know what they're referring to when they say the rapture, because and you know, the person that was conveying this to me, that term, he was saying that's how he describes what he's observing other people believing, the way that they talk with this religious rhetoric, the way that they talk about when AGI arrives, when superintelligence arrives, we all need to enter a bunker to protect ourselves. The person who was describing this to me was deeply skeptical of why do we need a bunker? There are people who think they must think that there's a rapture coming. And what does that, you know, mean? It's unclear because it is a belief system. So what do they believe? I mean, they haven't really articulated fully what the tenets of their Bible are. And what they're ultimately trying to achieve. But certainly I think the thing that I wanted to evoke in the book is that there are these really heady movements and ideas that have really infiltrated the AI world that the average person in public might not realize has actually significant play in how these people think and how they make decisions. And it really is, you know, I think this kind of strange culture is really a manifestation of when you think that you are doing something that could have humanity reaching consequences, you really start to feel that you need some kind of spiritual bedrock to cling on to. When you talk about what you're doing as we might be building digital gods and digital demons, I mean, I think there's a human psychology where no individual can really comfortably exist under that kind of burden, self-imposed burden. And so they gravitate towards these religious ideas that, you know, have been swimming in the water in our civilization for millennia.
And a key figure in the OpenAI story is, of course, Elon Musk, who was involved at the beginning, is now very disgruntled with how things have gone, I believe has a lawsuit going on against OpenAI. And he feels, I think, chiming with your argument, that they are being irresponsible with the potential power that they have, and they are pushing towards a very profit-seeking business rather than dealing with something on the very serious scale that it might be treated.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think to fully understand why Musk is making those arguments, you have to also understand that he and Altman are they're cut from the same cloth. They both are incredibly ambitious people that want to be the one in control of the next most consequential thing. And so the fact that Musk is not in control and Altman is in control is ultimately where all of Musk's accusations come from. He's saying, this guy shouldn't be trusted. I should be trusted. I'm the one that originally wanted OpenAI to not seek profit and not do this and not do that. But ultimately, when you look at the emails that Musk and Altman exchanged, which were opened up in court documents, actually Musk was proposing back then to also make OpenAI a for-profit. The difference just being that he would be the CEO instead of Altman. But this goes back to, yeah, I mean, ultimately, there is this aggressive race among all of the tech billionaires and all of the, you know, egotistical figures in Silicon Valley now to be the one that shapes AI in their image. So within the course of OpenAI's history, it's not just Musk that has parted ways and then become deeply upset with OpenAI's trajectory. There have been a string of leaders that have all done that. Dario Amodei, who's now the CEO of Anthropic, Ilya Sutskever, who's now the CEO of Safe Superintelligence, Mira Murati, who's now the CEO of Thinking Machines Lab, and all of them ultimately, they butted heads with Altman's vision of artificial intelligence or artificial general intelligence and had their own vision. And the way that they wanted to exert their vision was to then just form their own company and now enter this race where they try to compete with one another to see who will win out.
What sort of a lead does OpenAI have, really? I mean, a lot of its rivals, it seems, are catching or if not have already caught up with it. By your understanding, how much of a first mover advantage does it still have?
In terms of household name, OpenAI is still number one because most people know ChatGPT, but they wouldn't necessarily know Claude, which is Anthropic's chatbot equivalent. That said, their research capabilities, the research capabilities have become commoditized. So we're seeing now this shift where OpenAI and all of its competitors are moving away from releasing dramatically new and improved models to focusing a lot more on products, because it has now turned from a race of who has the best advancements to who can package it the most compellingly so that more users use our service. And that's part of the reason why in the last week we saw OpenAI announce that they were acquiring Jony Ive's company. Jony Ive, legendary designer who worked with Steve Jobs on the iPhone and the MacBook. Sam Altman has long been a Steve Jobs fanboy and has really fashioned himself as the next Steve Jobs. And so that's part of the reason why he struck this deal. But the other part is that he's really now trying to just create products that will beat the other company's products because they can't really create models that will beat the other company's models anymore.
Yes. I was very struck watching the video that that Sam Altman and Jony Ive did together, that it was a sort of incredibly slick, well-packaged presentation, but saying, I mean, other than announcing that they were forming a company, there was no clue as to what the product would be. And do we even know if they know what the product will be that they are creating?
Right. So I think it's become clear now that one of their first products is going to be a smart device that listens to everything that you do and watches everything that you do, to be a super assistant type device. And this is really rooted in Altman's obsession with the movie Her. He has long upheld that movie and the super assistant within that movie as a goal that OpenAI should strive towards. And ultimately, in order to do something like that, you need a device that collects an extraordinary amount of data on you, audio data, video data, is constantly analyzing everything that is happening in your life and your surroundings. And so I think that is the device that they are probably going to present first. But as I mentioned, users should be incredibly skeptical of this kind of device and buying it and allowing it to capture all this data, because ultimately, it's not just that they want to provide a super assistant. From a business perspective, all of these companies, their advantage is now how much data can they extract from users and from the general world to continue trying to advance their models, because they've tapped out of the internet. Everyone has already scraped the internet. And there is no comparable difference anymore. And so the only way to gain that competitive advantage from a data perspective is to tap into the source to get it directly from the user. Because if a user buys your device instead of, you know, Anthropic's device or Google's device or Microsoft's device, you're the one that's getting that data. No one else can scrape that freely from the internet. And if you can create some kind of, they call it internally a data flywheel, if you can create some kind of data flywheel where you get users more and more hooked and you get more and more market share, then in theory, in their conception of this competition, they then win the race. They then are able to continue pumping all of your data into their services to create more of an addiction to you.
And tech and now AI is, in some ways, it is the American stock market. It seems to drive whether the stock market's going up or down. It seems to be driven in large part about how the markets are feeling about AI. And it was very interesting that Altman went to Saudi Arabia with as part of the sort of the American delegation with Donald Trump. And from your argument there that you made earlier, one naturally thinks this is where the government has got to start stepping in and actually starting to control these things, or at least have some sort of say over where these companies are going. There isn't much sign of that happening at the moment, is there?
No, not at all. And, you know, the reason why my book is titled Empire of AI is because of this argument that I make that we really need to understand companies like OpenAI as new forms of empire. Silicon Valley has entered its empire era, where it has reached an apex power position in the global hierarchy of power, where it's pretty much more powerful than any other government now. There are very few, I mean, even the EU, you know, they fine these companies and these companies just consider it as a line item in their budget for the year. They don't really change their behaviors anymore. And so the only government that arguably is more powerful than Silicon Valley is the US government. But the US government has also entered its empire era. I mean, the Trump administration's rhetoric in recent months has made very clear that he thinks of the world as conquest as well. He wants to, you know, dominate Greenland and take land from Canada, and he wants to supercharge the kind of this kind of vision of the American empire and stretch its tentacles all around the world. And so we're seeing this unprecedented alliance between Silicon Valley and Washington, where when they have both entered that empire era and are hungering for conquest. And it's a tenuous alliance in the sense that Silicon Valley is trying to use the US government, and the US government's trying to use Silicon Valley, and both are trying to use the other as an asset to its own ambitions. But right now, while they are in alignment, you are seeing the Trump administration have zero interest whatsoever in the regulation of these companies because they see it as an asset to their own empire building. So that's why they are going to the Middle East, allowing the company to go to many other places to try and strike up deals, essentially, from the Trump administration's perspective, on behalf of the U.S. They are trying to install hardware and software, American hardware and software, in all of these parts of the world to more deeply entwine the dependence of other countries on U.S.-made products and services. But in the same way, Altman is really trying to use Trump's backing right now to ferry his own ambitions all around the world. And so obviously, this is deeply concerning. It is one that I think is probably one of the biggest threats to democracy that we face today, is this alliance, this allegiance, where neither of the two most powerful entities in the world have any interest whatsoever in preserving global democracy anymore. And what I think needs to happen next is, you know, people need to essentially wake up to the fact that this is happening and start being much more aggressive about protecting democratic rights, democratic norms, protecting, you know, the data that these companies get from us, the land that they're asking, the energy, the water, all of these resources that are required to develop their models. Because otherwise, like, if there is not this kind of pushback of the amount of political and economic power that they're accumulating and material resources that they're accumulating, you know, it can reach a point where it could be too late. At that point, they become the most powerful and they're sort of unstoppable.
I suppose in realpolitik terms, that sort of tech American-driven empire that you're talking about is a response to China, or a preempting of what we imagine China might do, because, of course, China doesn't have democratic accountability. And China's also very keen on its own empire of AI.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a big part of empire building is having a narrative that there are evil empires and there are good empires. You know, historically, that was always the case for why empires justified their existence, was they were the good empire and they need to beat out the evil empire. But the thing is, if you look at the track record of what this particular argument has gotten us in the last 10 years, it's actually just more authoritarian technologies. You know, like, we used to have much more of an optimistic view on the idea that American companies would develop technologies that would bring more democracy all around the world. But in using this argument, what about China, and pushing off regulation, warding off regulation successfully again and again and again and again, the track record is actually all of these American platforms and technologies are just as authoritarian. And they are leading to repression all around the world. They're leading to democratic backsliding all around the world. I mean, they're even fueling ethnic cleansing, you know? So clearly, this race is actually just a race to the bottom, and we should not continue to allow Silicon Valley to wield the What About China card, to allow them to play as techno-authoritarians unencumbered.
Do you think this kind of techno-authoritarianism has replaced what is now usually called neoliberalism, in the sense that the West used to push free markets and democracy, sometimes by force and often disastrously, but now it's tech has replaced democracy building as the kind of the modus operandi of the West?
I think so, because I think the US government now, I mean, I think every government around the world has always seen technology as a state building asset. But I think the US government has now realized that the largest companies in the world sitting on their soil under their jurisdiction is the greatest power building asset that they can have. And so I think the US is now, I mean, you know, depending on who you listen to, like the US has either always been power seeking or is now particularly power seeking. But regardless, you know, it has entered a point where whatever assets it can use to accumulate more power, it is now using. And so that has superseded any other ideas of liberalism. I mean, I think while we see an incredibly alarming crisis of leadership at the top of the U.S., it's really, really incumbent now on the rest of the world, especially, you know, democratic countries around the world, to recognize that it's not just that the U.S. is backsliding in democracy, but also that if they allow the things the U.S. is doing to continue to happen, that there will be democratic backsliding all around the world.
Well, Karen, it's been fascinating and slightly terrifying talking to you, but thank you very much for coming up to Americana, and congratulations on your new book. It's extremely interesting. Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening to it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.